Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Americans are famously industrious. The chart of our productivity growth per hour worked from 1948 to 2011 shows a rise of over 250%. It's the classic up and up and where it stops, nobody knows graph. But the fact is, while Americans work longer hours than workers in most other countries, we're actually less productive than you might think. According to a number of studies, working more than 40 hours a week just makes us less productive. So what would happen if we worked less? In this episode of Speakers Forum, you'll hear from journalist Bridget Schulte about why Americans are overworked, especially if you're a working mom, and how we might change that dynamic. Schulte says when a researcher insisted she had 30 hours of leisure time a week, she was first incredulous, then she got mad. That led her to set the record straight. The result is her book, Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. In it, she shares advice, personal stories, and statistical analysis that provide surprising insights into how productivity works, how we care for each other, and the crucial importance of play. If you're a parent, it will make you think twice when you tell your kids, just wait a minute, as you check work emails from home. And if you think you're a great multitasker, well, you might want to take a break and meditate on that. Bridget Schulte writes about work-life issues and the good life for The Washington Post. She's a fellow at the New America Foundation and a mom. Schulte spoke at Town Hall Seattle on April 20th, 2015. This talk was presented by Town Hall Seattle and Third Place Books as part of the Civics series. Thanks to Edward Wolcher for our recording.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for that wonderful introduction. Thank you guys for coming. I'm a native Oregonian, so I understand how rare it is to have beautiful weather like this and how hard it is to be inside when it's beautiful. So thank you so much for coming. So I want to start, talking about being overwhelmed. I think we all kind of know what that feels like. Anybody tend to feel a little stressed out maybe in the last week or so? Yeah, last 24 hours maybe? All right, well, let's start instead with the end in mind. Because when we're talking about overwhelmed, I think we all know what that feels like when you feel like you're hanging on by your fingernails and your hair's on fire. But what's the opposite of that? What are we really all searching for? And that's the good life. The Harvard psychologist Eric Erickson said the richest and fullest lives make time for the three great arenas of life: work, love, and play. And in the course of reporting this book, I would argue that we have an awful lot of work in the United States. We work among the longest hours of any advanced economy, save Japan and South Korea. And in South Korea, they actually have meditation prisons where you can go and get away from it all and check yourself into a little cell. And in Japan, they actually have a word for death from overwork called karoshi. Or they also have this wonderful word called shadow overtime, furoshiki, where you have to stay at the office until the boss leaves. And you may not do anything, but you've got to sit there till he leaves. So we're not quite that bad, but we're number three behind them. So we have an awful lot of work in the United States that impinges on the time we are able to spend in love with our family, with our friends, with our community. How many of us really know our neighbors or spend much time with them anymore? And I would argue that we do not play. How many of you think about it? When was the last time you really played? Anybody? Yesterday. Okay, that's one. All right. That's awesome. That's true. It's Monday, so hopefully you did play on the weekends. Oftentimes our weekends are filled with more stuff to do. So I want to, again, with the idea that I'm starting with the end in mind. If I do nothing else today, when I began this journey, I thought that leisure was a waste of time. I thought it was silly, stupid, unproductive. I had to be busy all the time. That was how I was virtuous. And I was wrong. And I hope tonight I convince you that leisure is very important. And if I do nothing else, I hope to give you a gigantic permission slip courtesy of neuroscience about why. Okay, so why do I have Mark Twain here? If you had gone to his farm in upstate New York one summer in the 19th century, this is how you would have seen him at least once, maybe twice a week. Outside, laying on his back, under the shade of a tree, staring up at the clouds. All right, so in the 21st century America, what would we think? What a loser, right? Get to work, you slacker. At the end of that summer, Mark Twain had written The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. There was an Amnesty International researcher who was stuck on a train between Manchester and London for 4 hours. And what'd she do? She stared out the window. She spaced out. She daydreamed. And at the end of that 4 hours, the author J.K. Rowling has said the entire Harry Potter series fell into her brain. Now, can you imagine what the world would have lost if she played Candy Crush for 4 hours? Because what we're discovering is that when we're idle, our brains are actually most active. That we have the task positive for the time we're concentrating, but we also have the task negative. And it lights up what's called the default mode network, which connects different parts of the brain like airport hubs that don't typically connect. So you could have a random thought, a stray memory, a snippet of a song, a piece of a dream, all come together in a completely fresh way for the moment of insight, the aha moment. There is a reason why you get your best ideas in the shower. We are wired for insight to come in moments of break from the action, of leisure, of idleness, of spacing out. So especially now when we're only as good as our next idea in this innovation economy, we all need to be spacing out a little bit more. But we don't. Most of us live in what I used to call time confetti. That's certainly how my time felt. Little scraps and snips and pieces and scraps of time just kind of bursting, everything all at once, all the time. So when I began this journey, let me just tell you how it all got started. This is what it felt like. I'm a working mom, 2 young kids. I work at the Washington Post, really demanding job. My husband, God bless him, we'd started out saying we'd be equal partners, and somehow I found that I was not only having it all, but I was doing it all. It's like, wait a minute, I'm wired to do the dishes and take the kids to the dentist while you watch TV? I don't get this. How did this happen? So everything was just kind of crazy. I felt like I was doing everything all at once, all the time. And I was appointed to this group at the Washington Post. We were looking at our readership numbers, and this is back before we'd made the switch to digital. And we were noticing, for the first time, a real big gap between male and female readers that we hadn't seen before. And so the powers that be put together this Women Readers Committee to figure out why. Why were women not reading the newspaper? And why that was important is because women over the age of 50 are the most loyal newspaper readers. So if you don't have women in their 20s and 30s reading the paper at the time, you extrapolate that out a couple decades, you don't have a market. So it was really critical to try to figure out why were women not reading the paper and what could you do about it. So I was appointed to this Women Readers Committee, mainly, I have to say, because I went up to an editor after they announced this at a big staff meeting, and the editor jokingly said, well, I think we just need to hire all these women babysitters. And everybody sort of laughed, and it just kind of ticked me off. And I went up to him afterwards, and I said, I can't tell you how many of my friends come up to me and apologize. And I say, Bridget, I'm really sorry, but I've just canceled my subscription. Because the newspaper comes every day, and it piles up, and it piles up, and it piles up, and I never read it, and it's one more thing to feel bad about. And so for that brilliant insight, which was basically what my entire, you know, all my friends were living, I got put on this Women Readers Committee. And so I walked in that first day, and sitting around this table are all women, and we sit down, and we did this kind of collective eye roll. It's like, why are women not reading the newspaper? Well, duh, women are busy. You know, the mornings are crazy for most women. Mornings in my house, this was my husband with his little half glasses on, reading the newspaper, kind of in that Maxwell Smart cone of silence. news of the world. Okay, and this is me, sort of like the Tasmanian devil, like emptying the dishwasher, loading the dishwasher, making the breakfast, making the lunch. Oh my God, it's picture day. Come back here. There's a stain on that shirt, and everybody's going to think I'm a terrible mother. You know, kind of craziness. What's this Girl Scout form? Oh my God, this was due 2 weeks ago. Why didn't you tell me? You know, so life was kind of crazy. And so we said, you know, we don't even have time to read the newspaper, and we work for the newspaper. And so, you know, being being reporters and journalists, we wanted to find, well, is there data about how busy women are? And not knowing anything, I said, well, I'll find out. So talk about the one time you raise your hand and you change your life. I never thought that would happen, but that happened at this point, because I went up to Google, God bless Google, and I just threw in these random search terms, busy, mother, women, time, and up pops this guy named John Robinson, and he studies time. I had no idea there was even such a field of time use research, and I called him up, and I said, we're doing this report, we figure women are too busy to read the newspaper, and he said, wrong. Women aren't busy. Women have 30 hours of leisure a week. Right, that's pretty much what I did. They have more leisure time now than they did in the 1960s, even though more of them are working in the marketplace. They don't have as much leisure time as men. Men have 40 hours of leisure. So yeah, it was one of those moments where I was frozen. I kind of felt like I'd been clonged on the head, like in those cartoons, like the big lump and the Tweety birds flying around. It's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have 30 hours of leisure. And he said, yes, you do. Come and do a time use study, and I will show you where your leisure is. So he sort of laid down this gauntlet. So I marched into this Women Readers Committee the next day. It's like, can you believe what this man just told me? You know, one more guy telling me what my life should be like in a way that didn't feel anything remotely what I was experiencing. And the woman who was running the committee at the time was also an editor at the magazine, and she said, go to the time study and write about it. So, and a year and a half later, I finally got around to it. I was pretty busy, you know, tracking my time. I would start tracking my time on Monday, and then I'd kind of stop doing it, and by Wednesday, I would have completely forgotten what I did on Monday. You know, Tuesday was just evaporated. It's like I knew I was really busy, but I had no idea what I'd done. I couldn't tell you. So I finally started tracking my time, and I gave him a call. He gave me this template to fill out, and I said, you know, you're supposed to write what you're doing and describe the activity. Is it sleep or personal care or work? And I called him up. I'm like, okay, I'm at work, so that's work. And I'm on the phone with you. Okay, so that's work. But I'm eating my lunch at my desk, so that's personal care. And I'm on the phone, and I'm on hold with the pharmacy because I got to refill my son's EpiPen prescription, so that's what, child care, housework. And my brother-in-law died in China, and I got to figure out how to get his ashes back, and I'm surfing the State Department website. I mean, what kind of time is this? And he just said, you know, just keep a diary and I'll figure it out. So I started keeping a diary. I took those little black books around that they said that Ernest Hemingway used to take around. I thought, well, maybe I'll get some inspiration here. So I started tracking my time, and I'd write down not only what I did, but how I felt about it. So it would be like 4 o'clock in Starbucks. Who are all these people sitting here drinking coffee? I hate them. So I finally tracked my time, and I brought it up to him, and he was going to analyze and find all this leisure time. And so one of the reasons I love the cover of my book so much is he took out a yellow highlighter, and I typed up 1 week, and he started highlighting everything that he called leisure. Lying in bed for 20 minutes, listening to NPR, trying to get out of bed. Screech. It's like, but I was tired. Leisure? You kidding? It's like, where's the hammock and the fruity drink, you know? Every time I got exercise, leisure, I'm like, I hate exercise. It just keeps me off of antidepressants. It's like, nope, exercise is leisure. And then I'd taken my daughter to a ballet class, and my beloved old station wagon broke down yet again, and I sailed over to the side of the road, and we waited for a tow truck for 2 hours. Screech. Leisure time. I'm like, you're kidding me. I was waiting for a tow truck. He said, oh, that's right. You were with your daughter. So that's childcare. So if I had been by myself by the side of the road, that would have been leisure time? And he shrugged and he goes, yeah. And I said, well, that doesn't feel very leisurely. He just sort of shrugged and he says, I measure time. I'm not a chronotherapist. As if I'm the one that needed you know, counseling or something. So he ended up finding 27 hours of what he called leisure, and I called bits and scraps of garbagey time confetti. And it made me wonder, what does all of that time confetti ever add up to? You know, I got the idea when I was cleaning up after my son's birthday party. You know, and it's beautiful, and there's all sorts of little fragments and bits and colors, but at the end of the day, what does it ever add up to? And I became sort of profoundly sad about that, because I was already feeling like I was living on the sidelines of my life as it was screeching past. And I didn't think that it could change. And it can. And I'm going to, this book is hopefully very hopeful, because I wanted to ask two questions. Why are things the way they are? Why do we feel so overwhelmed? Why is it so hard to have leisure time? Because I never felt like I deserved it. I felt very guilty about it. And I always felt much better if I was busy and industrious. And what was so interesting, I called a leisure researcher when I was doing the research for the book. And he said, well, tell me, well, you know, you have 27 hours that didn't feel like leisure. What does leisure feel like to you? And I was like, well, a sick day. You know, I don't have to do anything. And I just said, you know, but honestly, I just feel too busy to have leisure. And he said, ah, one of the seven deadly sins. I'm like, oh, great. So not only do I feel inadequate at work and inadequate as a mother, now I'm sinning? Oh, come on. And he said, yeah, because in the Middle Ages, sloth was one of the seven deadly sins. When you are sitting around, you're unmotivated, you're apathetic. But the flip side of that is something he said was acedia. And I said, well, what is that? He said, you know, it's like you're running on a treadmill and you don't know where the hell you're going, but boy, are you making good time. And he said, both are two sides of the same coin, because in both conditions, you're in a state of, you're disconnected from your own soul. You're in a state where you're not fully living a whole, full life. You're not being fully authentic. And so, So I began looking at, well, why do we not have leisure? I wanted to know, why are things the way they are, and how can they be better? But first I wanted to know, why should we care? Why should we care that we're feeling so overwhelmed? And I'll tell you, it's because we're all really stressed out. The United States, the World Health Organization, did a global mental health survey, and they have rated the United States as the most anxious country in the world. In our lifetimes, fully one-third of us will be anxious enough to be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. The average teenager today has as much anxiety as the average mental health patient did in the 1950s. So we're all incredibly stressed out. Now, a little stress is actually good for you. That's actually the way that we evolved. Back in the savannah, you had to really quickly sort, is that a tiger that's going to eat me? Is that something that I can eat? If it's a tiger, man, all of my blood and oxygen needs to flow from my brain to my muscles so I can run as fast as I can back to the cave to safety. And then once you were safe, your blood pressure would normalize, your breathing would come down, and you would have this stress and release action. They call it allostasis. And that's actually the way we perform best. Before a race, before you get up in front of a crowd and talk to people. A little stress is good for you. Keeps you on your toes. Nope. Not sure what I'm doing here. Am I doing something? Okay, well, anyway, that's a little stressful too. Maybe I'll take my coat off so it won't keep brushing against it. So, okay, a little stress is good there now. Allostasis coming back to like, coming down a little bit. But what we're discovering is that stress is not only bad for our bodies, and we know that when you're constantly bathing your organs in cortisol and the stress hormones, it's been related to high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, inflammation, even cancer. But I spent some time at the Yale Stress Center where they're beginning to study what does stress do to the brain. And what they're finding in that little yellow blob there, that's the prefrontal cortex, that is our most recently evolved part of our brain. It governs where we think, learn, remember, make decisions. And what they're discovering is that in these functional MRI tests, people who had two conditions, they both had been through stressful events in the past year, and who hasn't? And they also had the perception that they were very stressed out. Their prefrontal cortex was fully 20% smaller in volume than people who did not feel so stressed out. Okay, so stress shrinks your brain, so we got to care, not to worry. Because Harvard is doing some other really interesting studies. The brain, what we're discovering is the brain is really plastic. The structures of the brain change depending upon how you think and how you act and how your culture influences you. And so what they were looking at is we've known for some time that monks who go and meditate in caves for 5 months, they have amazing brain structures. Okay, I don't know about you, but I don't have 5 months to go and meditate in a cave. You know, now my kids are older, they probably would like me to go and meditate in a cave for 5 months. So they wanted to find, all right, what can everyday people, is there any benefit that they can gather from meditating or mindfulness or being quiet? And so they took two groups of people, and they had one go through their regular stressful lives, and they had another group go through an 8-week-long mindfulness-based stress reduction program. And they took functional MRIs of their brains at the beginning of that 8 weeks, and then again at the end. And what they discovered is that people who'd gone through their stressful lives, there was no change in their brain structures. But the people who had gone through the 8-week-long training program, their brains expanded in 4 distinct regions of their brain that have a lot to do with self-consciousness, self-identity. And there, the hippocampus, that little horseshoe-shaped guy, which is the seat of emotion control, they actually expanded. So I found what's most profoundly hopeful is that they found those structural changes in as little as 27 minutes a day of either meditating, doing yoga, or simply being mindful. And all that means is being right where you are. When I talked a little earlier about feeling that contaminated time, what contaminated time is when you are lost in your thoughts, when you are everywhere and nowhere at once. And that happens an awful lot to women. Women tend to ruminate. You could be in a situation that looks like leisure on the outside. Maybe you're on a bike ride. But on the inside, you're thinking, oh my God, what about this? Did I do the carpool? What about the groceries? What about this? Oh my gosh, I forgot about this at work. You're constantly lost in your thoughts. And so you're everywhere and nowhere at once. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important to have that leisure time to play, because it throws you out of your head and into the moment. So that's really tough to do when we look at our workplaces, in particular the way it's set up, all these wonderful open space office plans. The average knowledge worker today is interrupted about every 3 minutes. And if you're not interrupted, it's by a coworker or your Facebook, you got a new notification, your email dings, something's happening. And so we're constantly dividing our attention. So everyone's time is becoming more and more fragmented. And it's very difficult to get anything done and concentrate and sink into what psychologists call a state of flow, where you have long stretches of unbroken, concentrated time, which is actually where we have our peak human experience. So all of our time is getting fragmented. And we also think it's great if we multitask. We value busyness. Oh, look at how great I am. I can do 2 and 3 things at once. And we tend to think there's this mythology that women are better at multitasking. And right now, I'm here to tell you that's not true. We really don't know that yet. The science of trying to figure out how men and women's brains, how we're the same and how we're different, is very young. And right now, the best we know is that there's more variation within gender than there is across gender. So you're not better at multitasking. Nobody can do 2 things that require attention at once and do either one very well. There's a study that was done in the UK that found multitasking makes you as stupid as being stoned. Yes. And now that pot is becoming legalized all over the place, I suppose we can test that out. We also live under the tyranny then of the to-do list, what I used to call the tyranny of the to-do list. I would always put all this stuff on that I had to do, you know, 75 million things, and I think I had to get through them all. And I'd get to the end of the day and I would never have done half of them. And then you feel like such a failure. The other thing that I would feel like is I lived what I called the if-then mentality, that if I got through all of the stuff on the to-do list, then I could relax, then I could have fun, then I could take leisure. And I never got to then. I always lived in if. And so one of the most brilliant things that I found are people, at first I was thinking, well, I guess we just have to burn our to-do lists. But to-do lists actually have a function, as long as they don't rule you. So if you take the time to figure out what's most important to you, kind of take a pause, take a breath, jump off that treadmill, figure out what's most important to you, and then put that high Put the things that give you joy, that give you meaning, put that high on your to-do list. Do that first. And do one thing a day, not 75. And do it first when your willpower is freshest. And this is one of my favorite to-do lists. This is Johnny Cash's to-do list. And if you look, number one, things to do today. Number one, not smoke. That's a good one. Number two, kiss June. Number three, not kiss anyone else. Very important. So I want to start, you know, when I wrote about work, love, and play, and I want to talk about the thing that we hardly ever talk about, and that's play and leisure time. Why do we never play? Well, I got to tell you, I wanted to figure out, well, you know, why did I value busyness over leisure and idleness? Why did I think that was better, and it made me a better worker and a better person? And so I wanted to look, was anybody studying busyness and the fast pace of life? And I went to an archive where lots of work-life researchers file their stuff, and I found one researcher in Fargo, North Dakota, who studies busyness and the fast pace of life. And I called her up. I'm like, Fargo? Are you kidding me? You know, I live in Washington, D.C. People are nuts there, you know? Type A, working all the time, bragging about how late they, you know, if you spend the night at the office, you get like a little gold star, right? It's like crazy busy people. And I'm like, Fargo, I thought everybody would be sitting out on their porch and, you know, enjoying a slow life. And she said, oh, honey, you want to meet some overwhelmed North Dakotans? I can arrange that. And so she did. She put together a focus group, and I got to sit in on it. And there we were at the Radisson, 18 stories high, the tallest building in all of Fargo. And sitting around the table are these incredibly stressed out North Dakotans. There was one woman, a young woman, she said she was so stressed out that she just figured she had no time, she would never have children. She already decided. There was a woman there who said, yeah, the last time I had leisure was probably sitting in my doctor's office waiting for my mammogram. Like, bleh. I don't think that when the Greeks wrote about leisure, that's what they were talking about. You know, and then this other guy said, I'd love to go canoeing. Yeah, I even have a canoe, but I just feel so guilty. It's like the Protestant work ethic is so strong. I feel like the idle hands are a devil's workshop. I never let myself go canoeing. And then this woman comes bursting in and her hair's flying. And she goes through this long list of all the stuff that she's had to do. And she's really double and triple booked. And she really shouldn't be here. She's got another meeting she really should go to. And then I got stuck in traffic. Okay, this is Fargo, right? And so I'm like, traffic, wow. And I look out the window and I see one traffic light. I see three cars. I see cornfields. And at that point, I turned to Anne Burnett, the researcher that I was out there, and her contention is that busyness has become something that we value so much that it is now a status symbol. It's how we show we're important and we fit in, so that sometimes we will create busyness when it does not exist, like a traffic jam in Fargo, North Dakota. And the way she came upon this is she studies holiday letters. And so we spent an afternoon going through her archive. Let me tell you, man, she studies language, and she circles language. And when you look at it, you know, we started in the 1960s, and it was blessings of the season. Oh, we're so grateful you're in our lives. Lovely, beautiful, long handwritten letters. And man, and then they become typewritten, and then there's stuff written in the margins, and everybody's really busy. And this one couple, we went to 7 states over Memorial Day, and these are the big Midwestern states, you know, it's like craziness. This one woman bragging about, I drive 100 miles a day in my carpool. I had to take a nap after I read some of these letters. Just people are so crazy busy, and some of the letters had this A on them. And I looked at her and I said, hey, like, is that a good letter? Like, why do you have grading these Christmas letters? And she said, no, A is for authentic. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, to be truly authentic, you have to keep 2 ideas in mind. One is that you're alive, and one is that you will die. Because our lives are short. And so to be truly authentic, you have to have both of those principles in mind. And I said, so how many of these Christmas letters are authentic? And like this huge, long pile, she said, maybe these 6. So in our busyness, it's like that same sense of acedia. We are being inauthentic. We are not truly connected with our souls and what's important. We're not playing. Play actually is what makes us human. There are very few species that play as juveniles. There are some mammals that do. but humans are the only species that play as juveniles and as adults. Now, what does that mean? It's like, okay, so we dress up at Halloween. That's not really, it's not like we're going to have tea parties. But play, having an open, curious mindset, a playful attitude, being open to trying new things and novelty, it sculpts our brains to keep them open, adaptable, and flexible, and creative. And in turn, we can create open, adaptable, flexible, and creative societies. There was a Dutch philosopher who said that we should not be called Homo sapiens, the thinking human or the rational human, but Homo ludens, the playing human. And there's not a whole lot of play research done. Actually, the best vacation research that I found is actually done in Europe because they actually take vacation. Because here in the United States, we don't. The United States is the only advanced economy, well, unless you include countries like Nepal and like Suriname, and we're the only advanced economy that doesn't have a paid vacation policy. I think Washington State, you've got some bills pending in the state legislature, but I think you're the only one. About 1 in 4 American workers has no access to paid vacation at all. They tend to be low-wage workers. Those of us who do get vacation tend to take, we get about 10 to 14 days on average. Most of us don't take all of that time. And if we do, we take work along with us. Anybody want to confess up? Most of the time when I talk to people, they'll say, if I don't check my emails, I dread my first day back in the office. So everybody's checking their emails. There was a study done of rats, though. I think this is a really important thing to remember. Rats play as juveniles, but not as adults. And so they wanted to understand why was play important. And so they took these two groups of rats, and this one group they put with adults, so they never learned how to play. And one group did. They played with other juveniles. And then they put these two groups into a very stressful situation where there'd been a predator, and they put them there. And all the rats ran away, obviously. They smelled danger and they went to safety. But it was only the rats who had played that eventually came out and began exploring to see if it was still safe. The rats who never learned to play, many of them never came out, and some of them died. So play helps keep you open to the possible. Play is what helps you imagine a future and then take the time to make it happen. Now, women don't play. Women have never had a history or culture of leisure. When I was researching this book, I sat down with these two eminent time use researchers, leisure researchers, and they gave me this grand disquisition of the history of leisure in all of humankind. And when we were done, I said, that's all really interesting. What you have talked about are high status men. You haven't said anything about women. And if you look at the classic book on leisure, Thorsten Veblen's The Theory of the Leisure Class, he dispenses with women on page 2. He said the drudge work of society is done by the servants, the slaves, comma, and also all the women. So when people tell you to just do it, to go play, it's really hard because it never feels like it's okay. There was a study done in the 90s by feminist leisure researchers. I mean, who even knew there was such a thing, right? Feminist leisure researchers, they were looking at women's leisure throughout the world, and what they discovered is that it didn't matter your age, your race, the country you lived in, the religion you believed in, your ethnicity, that 2 of 1, women believed they did not deserve leisure time. They had to earn it. And the only way to earn it was to get to the very end of that really long to-do list, which, guess what? Never ends. And so you live your life in busyness, in going to the next item on the to-do list, in kind of fragmented, scattered time confetti. And so one of the things that I want to do in my book, this is a very, we're really at a fascinating, we're at the cusp of a massive sea change in gender roles, really for the first time since the Pleistocene era, perhaps. And it's now time for all of us to reclaim that sense of time, to get into the sense of flow, to do away with a sense of fragmented time, and that recapture and embrace leisure for all, and that includes women. So yes, women don't play, you gotta play anyway. This is me, I went on a play date, it's in the book, I couldn't believe it, I put it off for so long, because again, I didn't think it was important, so This is a trapeze class that was a group of women that are trying to get women to start playing. And I put it off for so long, this was the only thing I could do before my manuscript was due. And I'm terrified of heights, and that was really scary. But it was also amazing because it did. It threw me out of my head, out of my thoughts. I didn't have time to think, do I look fat in that, you know, my sweatpants, and, you know, does my hair look okay? It throws you out of your head and into the moment, and you feel fully alive. Okay, so why is that hard to do for so many of us? We spend an awful lot of our time at work. I don't know if you remember this Cadillac commercial. Like, why do we work so hard, you know, for stuff? Well, yeah, we're Americans. We're hard charging, you know. We all work all the time, and that's what makes us great. You know, it's really not. He talked about the Wright brothers. It says, you know, they worked all the time, and they made the airplane, invented the airplane. The Wright brothers closed their busy bicycle shop in Ohio, and they moved to the beach in North Carolina, and in their leisure time, they invented the airplane. You know, Bill Gates is another one who's famous for overwork, but he would also take two weeks to go on what he called think breaks, to just think great thoughts, to collect his thoughts, to get away from things. So who do we think the ideal worker is? Somebody who comes in early, who stays late, who eats lunch at their desk. If you're in Silicon Valley, then you spend the night at the desk. WFD Consulting, they asked executives and managers all around the world, who is the best and most ideal worker? 3/4 of them said, someone with no caregiving responsibilities. Well, so who is that? You know, it's certainly not women. And these days, men are doing more childcare and housework than ever. Women are still doing more, but men's time with children has tripled in the last couple decades. If you look at surveys, particularly of younger men, they want to be involved fathers. They don't want to be a distant paycheck, they say. They don't want to be stuck at work. So we have managers and CEOs who value this ideal worker who really doesn't exist anymore. And yet all of our workplace cultures, when you look, economists have done studies, and who do we value? We value these workers, we pay them more, we think they're the best, and you know what, they're not. And what convinced me is when you look at hourly productivity. So yes, we put in an awful lot of long hours, particularly office workers in the United States, but how many of those are really good hours? Right now, the 40-hour work week, the 8-hour day, it's a remnant of Henry Ford, who was trying to figure out how far you could push a manual laborer before they got sick and stupid and mad and, you know, would do, you know, slow down their work. And that was where you got the 40-hour work week. Well, we don't know really how far you can push a knowledge worker before they become little more than a butt in the chair and you burn out. There was one study done that said you could probably push people to work 60-hour work weeks for a couple weeks, you know, if you have a big project or something to push through, but after that, you're on the road for burnout, and it takes you 2 and 3 times as long to do anything, and you make stupid mistakes. And so the International Labor Organization, the OECD, they look at hourly productivity, like how many of those hours are really good. And this is what blew my mind. I thought I worked like an ideal worker a lot. You know, I'm trying to work like a maniac. I stay late. I'm going to put my hours in. Never mind if tomorrow I'm tired, it's going to take me 3 times as long to do stuff. But they were looking at hourly productivity, and when you divide GDP per hours worked to get that measure, look who's the most productive per hour. It's not us, it's Norway. And they work a 35-hour work week by law, which many of us would consider part-time. And look at who's about as productive per hour as we are. France. Oh, and we love to make fun of France and their 30 days of paid vacation and their paid parental leave and their subsidized childcare. But they're about as productive per hour as we are. So what about those hours? How many of you have heard of the 10,000 hours, the deliberate practice that you need 10,000 hours to be really excellent at anything? Okay, so what did we do when this came out? Well, like classic Americans, we thought, you have to power through those 10,000 hours and just do it, you know, power through completely start to finish and play the cello until my fingers fall off. What we missed, though, what many of us missed, is that this 10,000 hours came from a study done by a Florida psychologist named Anders Ericsson, and he wanted to understand what did it take to be really excellent at anything. And so he went to Berlin to study how musicians at a conservatory there, how they spent their days. How did they use time through the day? And so, no offense to the teachers here, but this is what he found for teachers. You know, the people who were kind of on the lowest track at this very high level place, their days didn't really have a whole lot of variation. This is what he found of the virtuosos. They worked in intense bursts early in the morning. They would work for no more than 90 minutes, and then they would nap. They rested more. They worked in intense bursts and then rested. And so what we're discovering, what they found with that, is just as we have 90-minute sleep cycles at night, we have 90-minute attentiveness cycles during the day. And the best workers understand that. Just like we have the stress, the pulse and release with stress, we have those same kind of cycles with work. And so now there's more of a movement toward effective work, where you will work, you know, do your one most important thing, figure out the day before what it is, the one thing that's important to do, try to do it first when your willpower is freshest, do it for no more than 90 minutes, and then take a break, go for a walk, and see if inspiration hits. And then come back and do another pulse. One of the things that I looked at was, where were things shifting already? Were there new kind of work cultures, new ethics coming? You know, we've got all this wonderful technology. Is it freeing us? There's really good evidence that shows that teleworkers, yes, it gives you a lot more control over your time, but you end up working more. And my argument is they probably end up working more, and I'm one of them. I work long hours sometimes. I'm still working on that. Because if you're attached to a kind of a workaholic or an ideal worker culture, you're going to meet that culture. So there are places that are completely shifting their cultures, and this is one of them that I profile in the book. It's Menlo Innovations. It's in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I walked in one morning, and they work in pair partners, and their whole philosophy is they work short, bounded hours. And then their boss, who founded the company on one principle, and that's joy, he wants people to be out. He does not want you to answer emails, work emails, and cell phone calls at the end of the day, because he wants you to be with your family, to go canoeing, to light up that default mode network, because maybe tomorrow you'll come in and you'll not only be healthier, rested, and refreshed, but maybe you'll figure out a new way to solve an old problem. So the other thing that he does is he recognizes to be joyful, you have to be authentic. And to be authentic, you have to have work, love, and play. So they have a program there they call Menlo Babies, because he understands that in more than 30 states, infant care is more expensive than a year of college. And it's very difficult to find. It's hard to find. It's hard to afford. So he lets people bring their babies in. And I walked in, and they work in pair partners. They were working on this complicated computer code, which, of course, I did not understand. And the guy has a burp cloth on his shoulder and his four-month-old baby and he's holding her, kind of doing the parent rock and writing. And I look at the guy, it's like, how do you get any work done with babies around here? And the boss, the CEO, turns to me and goes, babies make people nicer. So different companies are finding different things that work for them. So the flip side of this, though, just like we have these very strong and powerful notions about the ideal worker, we also have very powerful notions about the ideal mother. And I can tell you from doing the research, the standards for what we think a good mother should be and do have never been higher. And at the same time, mothers are still doing about twice the housework and twice the childcare, even though men's time has increased, because we have this notion of what the good mother should be and do. And one of the things that I wanted to look at, again, we have no paid vacation policy. Why do we have no policies that recognize that we have a majority of mothers who work in this country? We have most of the kids in this country are being raised in either dual income or single working parent families. Maybe 1 in 4, 1 in 5 kids are raised in that traditional homemaker breadwinner families. Why do we not have policies that support it? Why do we not have workplaces that understand that and support it? And I traced it back to Pat Buchanan. Back in the early 1970s, there was actually when women and mothers were entering the workforce for really two reasons. The women's movement opened up possibilities for women, so women wanted to work, and also because as wages started to stagnate and costs continued to rise for many working class families, Mothers had to work to keep the same standard of living. So you had this influx of mothers and women into the workplace. And there were Harris and Gallup polls at the time. If you look, it's fascinating. It says, hey, more mothers are working now. Should we help them out with childcare? And should the government help? And a majority of Americans said, yeah, that's a good idea. And so there was a bipartisan effort in Congress, and Republicans and Democrats in both the House and Senate crafted a universal childcare bill. And Nixon's White House and his health, education, and welfare secretary actually was working behind the scenes to craft this. It would have been high quality, easily affordable on a sliding scale, easy to access. Well, it got to the White House, and Pat Buchanan was one of the new young right people working there. And he took one look at that, and he convinced Richard Nixon to veto it. And I went to Pat Buchanan, I have a chapter in the book, and I asked him why he did that. And he said that a few years before, he'd gone to the Soviet Union, and he saw all these like little kids in their young pioneer outfits marching around in lockstep and spouting Leninist doctrine. And he was terrified that childcare in the United States would turn the United States into the Soviet Union. It would turn all our children into these factory-raised automatons. And he said, and what makes America great is its families. He said, so we not only wanted to kill the bill, we wanted to kill the very idea of childcare in the United States. And he did, because we've really never talked about it again, nor have we talked about parental leave. And again, we are the only advanced economy that has no paid parental leave for either mothers or fathers. There are some companies that give fathers maybe one day, and there are fathers who are too afraid to take it. So we don't have these supportive structures. We have these incredibly high standards for what we think a mother should be and do. And we have all this mother guilt. I was soaked in guilt, thinking I was a terrible, terrible mother because I was a working mother. And why? We think that mothers have abandoned their kids. And there was a study that came out in the 1980s that said that's exactly what happened. It was what we were most afraid of. If mothers went to work, kids would be neglected and abandoned. So there was a study that found that's true. Women hardly ever see their kids. So the press, all of my friends in the press, we went wild with it. You know, mean, nasty working mothers never see their kids, they're selfish, they're awful people. And honestly, in my book, I argued that this is when some of the mother guilt started. Because the guy who wrote that study was John Robinson, the same guy who told me I had 30 hours of leisure. And he was wrong. He made a miscalculation. And by the time he realized it and tried to correct it, and called all those reporters back saying, you know, that story, it's not really right, you're going to have to take it back. It was too late. Nobody wanted to listen to him. And also what he found initially with the incorrect information just reinforced what everybody already believed. So all of this guilt, all of this time that we just pour into our kids, it's based on basically an addition error. And what's happened since is actually everyone spending more time with their kids. Working mothers today spend as much or more time with their kids than at-home mothers did in the 60s and 70s. You ask, how is that even possible? Well, because they've given up time for sleep, time for personal care, and almost all of their leisure time is spent with their kids. And you know what? That's not good for anybody. There was a study done not long ago that I wrote about for the Washington Post, and it looked at all of this quantity of time, because the time has really increased that we spent with our kids. Has it mattered? What's it mattered for the kids? And they found no relationship between quantity of time and children's emotional outcomes, their emotional well-being, behavior, and cognitive functions like math and science, math and reading scores. All that time, the quantity doesn't matter. It's the quality that matters. Because what we're also finding is that kids need just what we need, unstructured time to play, to imagine, to fail, to pick themselves up, to get bored, learn how to get unbored, to try something new, to sculpt their brains in new ways. I'll tell you one last story, because I think, am I getting the rounded up signal? So just as we've talked about how women are still doing twice the housework and childcare. Is that me? Are you sure that's... afraid to touch it. So just as women are doing twice the housework and twice the childcare, I argue that in the holidays, it's often what I call the third shift. So I'll tell you a very brief story. It's set the scene. It's Thanksgiving a couple years ago, and my husband and I were hosting 18 people. Why? Because I not only have the ideal worker living in my head, and I've got the ideal mother living in my head, I got Martha Stewart up in there. So I've got 18 people coming over. I've like got the kitchens looks like the like a bomb's gone off. I've got like vegetables I'm chopping. My wonderful sister Claire was here tonight. She was there helping me. We're chopping. We're going crazy. The table's not set. We're still in our sweaty running clothes because we ran the neighborhood turkey trot. And my husband comes over to the fridge. He opens it, and I think he's going to put the turkey in the oven, and he takes out a six-pack of beer. And he looks at me and he says, I'm going to go and help Peter smoke his turkey. I'm like, you're going to go sit in the sun in the patio and drink beer all afternoon while I'm getting this dinner ready? And he kind of shrugged and he walked out the door. Now, I had a knife in my hand. You know, the greatest thing about writing this book is I got to tell that story on National Public Radio. And my husband is a reporter for National Public Radio, and he covers the military. And after I told this story, he got a call from this woman colonel, and he said, you know, Tom, if you were my husband, you wouldn't have gotten out the door. But then again, I'm a trained killer. So he walked out the door, and in that moment, I was livid, but I was also profoundly sad, because when we had gotten married, we made a promise to each other that we would do it differently. I love and respect my parents very much, but they had a very traditional marriage, and I didn't want that. I wanted a partner. I wanted to be equal. And somehow, over 20 years, we had gone from, we were pretty equal before kids came, and then once that child came, man, all of a sudden we thought, I guess I was doing everything. And so we started doing the only thing I knew how to do as a reporter, and that was we'd go on long walks, and I took a reporter's notebook, and I started interviewing him. You know, why did you never take parental leave? Because that's when it all started, when I had the time with the kid, and I got to know what this cry meant and that meant, and he got none of that. And he said, you know, we had a policy on the books, but I was too afraid to take it, and I was too afraid to tell you. And so if there's one policy that we could change, I would argue it's for early solo parental care for men. Because when you start early and you develop the time to understand the competence and you get the confidence of dealing with a kid on your own, it changes your relationship with the kid and it changes the family dynamic totally. Because if you're going to help women lean in to what I would argue should be a changed workplace, you got to help men lean out. And that's how we can bring more time for everybody. So we're much better now. We started, it was tough. We started with trying to come up with systems for what would work. And so in the morning, we decided I would empty the dishwasher, he would load it, and if he didn't, I wouldn't do it for him. I would take a picture and text it to him and say, really? And so now it's much better. So what I've discovered, though, is that in more fairly sharing our home life, in trying to rein in the ideal worker and have more effective work. Not only do we have more time for ourselves, we have more time to play, and we have more space in our heads to think. So thank you so much for having me, and I would love to have a conversation and answer any questions you've got.
It was wonderful. Thank you so much. I'm at the beginning, hopefully of not a long timeline. My sweetheart is beginning to get dementia. We were at a talk earlier, and it's so important to take care of yourself, because if you don't, everything else falls apart, including your family, your kids, your husband, and your sweetheart. So thank you so much. It was invaluable.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. You know, and I will say that, you know, all of this hard work, what does it get us? You know, we live shorter, sicker lives than many of our counterparts in advanced countries. And all of this work that we so value, you know, we also have high rates of burnout. There's a study that's being done by the National Institutes of Health. And not surprisingly, healthier workers, healthier people are better workers. Why this doesn't translate into corporate America is a huge question, because it actually makes you not only more loyal, but actually more productive, more efficient, and more innovative.
I totally agree with you on that point. But I wanted to start at the end, because I was interested that you and your husband worked out this system of sharing the dishes and taking alternate roles. And I'm wondering, I don't know how old your kids are, but do you have them do the dishes? And if not, why not? And one of the things that I notice is how much less kids do today than they did when we were kids. And I'm wondering, have you studied that at all, and do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Kids are not doing as many chores as they used to, and I think they should. It's really important. It gives them a sense of being part of what makes the family work. But it's all part of what I call the cult of intensive parenting. There are ethnologists and sociologists who study this that say we're not just child-centered, we've become child-dominated. And so we overschedule our kids, we overprotect them, we think that, you know, we need to put them in bubble wrap. I've been writing these stories about the family in Maryland who let their kids walk home from a park. And just last Sunday, their kids were taken by, you know, a neighbor called the police, and they were taken to Child Protective Services for 5 hours. And the guy who called the police said, well, I didn't want to scare the kids. It's like, oh, and they're not, like, terrified by being at Child Protective Services for 5 hours? You know, so we're kind of in this really weird time in our society where we think our parenting standards are really, frankly, way out of control. And it's not good for us, but it's also not good for our kids. When you look at, say, freshmen in college, about a quarter of those kids are on antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication. And why? Because they've never had to make their own decision. They don't know how to fail. They don't know how to pick themselves up. They don't even know what they like, because they've always been, now you will do cello, now you're going to go to join the soccer team. Oh, not just soccer, now you got to go to the travel soccer team. So we've all got, it's all like spinning this sense of fear. There's so much uncertainty about the future, and we're all terrified that our kids are somehow not going to make it. So we start early by kind of overdoing it, and we're not doing anybody any favors. Because all the stress that we're feeling, that's actually what is the worst thing that you can do. That stress actually acts like a contagion or a virus. You know, the cortisol gets into your kids. And you know, it's really sad that when I've done stories looking at sort of these parenting standards, I was in this one very wealthy area, and I was talking to a tutor, and she said, it's the saddest thing I can see. The parents are so demanding, and the kids are so withholding. You know, they're always at loggerheads because they think that that's the only thing that the parents care about. So it's the one thing they try to take away from them. And she said, you know, these families, they don't even talk because it's all about achievement. And I think what's interesting to note is that when they've done these meta-analyses of studies, if you parent for happiness first, that sense of authenticity, what the kids like, what they're good at, if you parent for happiness, achievement comes. Because if you're happier, then it's going to be a much more authentic kind of achievement. But yes, our kids are 14 and 16, and they do. This is breakfast, but they do. They do the dishes. My son's supposed to do the garbage. My daughter's supposed to do the kitty litter and feed the cat, which she doesn't always do. But they do have chores, and they need to do them more. They're supposed to clean up their rooms once a week, but I don't clean them up for them anymore. And they all do their own laundry, yeah, which means sometimes it doesn't get done. If they want to wear dirty clothes, it's, yeah, your choice.
Hi. Really enjoyed your book. It seems like lots of women, even young women, are going into their careers with the idea that they will flex their schedules. And I know I did, and I'm married to a man who is the president of a company. And as we have these conversations about splitting things at home, I've also talked to him about trying to flex his work more, and he is finding it hard, even as the president of a small company, to change the culture of the company. And so I'm wondering if you could, in the book you talk about like the benefits and you know, how these changing cultures at work actually, you know, create more productive, you know, work hours and whatnot. So if you could speak to that a little more.
Yeah, do you want him to? You want him to just call me?
Yeah,
I'd be happy to talk to him.
Yeah, actually, I would love to do that.
Yeah, because he's got the power to change the culture, and so what's hard, I would imagine, is you know, like change is hard for anybody, and especially if that's all you know. And we've all bought into this mythology that working like a crazy maniac is what's going to really, you know, be the right answer, and that's going to get us the farthest. You know, and I don't want to say that hard work isn't important. Hard work is important. But overwork doesn't work. And, you know, when you are the CEO, you do have the power to change the culture. And so it seems like what he's got to do is change his mindset mm-hmm. and not only value work, but also value the other arenas of life. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't value caregiving in this country. But you can start. Mm-hmm. And he's got the power to do it. Mm-hmm. Tell him to call me.
Thanks. This is something I think about a lot. So, two related things. I see that in your story, the arc of your talk was interesting, and then you ended with how you and your husband have sought this further equality in your partnership, and that's fantastic. And I've separately read articles about how that changes the nature of your love and romance and like your sex life and everything, which I like don't want you to talk about, but I wonder where, you know, if that changed.
I'm not going to talk about that. No.
But I wonder if your equality in your marriage has changed the dynamic of your love there in some way. But separately and related, I wonder if you've also read about the partnership of household and childcare tasks around same-sex couples and how that works, because the anecdotes that were told were all heterosexual couples.
You're right, and I apologize because I should have mentioned this, and I do write about it in the book, that heterosexual couples can take a real page, can really learn from same-sex couples, because when you take the gender dynamic out of it, it becomes a much fairer division of labor. Because then you divide not by, you know, oh, you're a guy, so you should do the yard work. Oh, you're a girl, you should do the dishes. It's much more on, what do you like? What are you good at? And actually, that is one of the things that we've done. I like yard work, so I do it. You know, Tom likes to go out on adventures, so go to the grocery store, have an adventure, you know? You know, I'm more of a homebody, so I don't mind doing the laundry. You know, and then we all fold it together as a folding partner. But the same-sex couple is a really good point that you make. And then, you know, to your point about sex lives, and I'm not going to talk about mine because it's none of your business, and I didn't write about it. But what I will say is, you know, that was based on, there was a New York Times magazine piece that came out not long ago, and it was basically making the argument using data. And there are sort of two competing studies, which is so interesting, and they use the same data set. And so one study says that if men do more housework, then they become less attractive. They become more, you know, if once you're equal, then sort of your love and your sex life fizzles out. It's just no longer exciting. That what you really need is, you know, the cad rather than the dad. And that makes, you know, you need difference. And that makes it mysterious and exciting. And then your sex life is spicy. So that very same data set, another group used that and said, if you have more equal sharing, you have more sex. So how can that possibly be? You know, it's the same study, and you get more sex or you get less sex. Well, first of all, it's a really old study, and we need better numbers. We need better data. And nobody really understands human sexuality, honestly, and what works and what doesn't, and what works for some people and what doesn't. But I think that it is pretty clear that they were looking at different tasks of housework. And if you look at just housework in general, that's where you get the idea that if you do housework in general and you are more, you know, equally sharing, you know, if housework, yes, then you have more sex. So We need more data, follow same-sex couples, and, you know, figure it out.
My question is not about sex. I am curious how long it took you to write the book, as well as why now? Why did you decide to write a book versus, you know, some of the other stories that you've written in the past?
Well, that's a good question. I've had opportunities, if you will. I wrote a magazine story on Morgellons disease. You know, Joni Mitchell, she had Morgellons disease, and the CDC was studying it, and so they asked me to do a magazine story. And it was like, you know, people have fibers growing out of their skin and they itch, and so somebody said, "You want to write a book about that?" I was like, "No, not really." You know, I would come home from interviewing people and like basically sanitize my clothes. And no offense to people who were suffering from Morgellons, but it was scary. This book, why this book and why now? You know, honestly, I didn't have any grounding in these issues at all. I didn't want to write about women's issues. I didn't want to write about work-life issues. I thought they were sort of soft. And, you know, I wanted to write about politics. I've covered the Pentagon. I wanted to write about, you know, macho tough stuff. And I've described it as a completely accidental book. And honestly, it's the same thing. I wrote this magazine story. I kind of fell into it when John Robinson laid down this challenge that, you know, you have 30 hours of leisure. And, you know, part of me was so angry. I wanted to prove that he was wrong. And part of me was really terrified, because what if he was right? And I was sort of frittering away my one and only life. And so I did that magazine story, and then a couple people approached me and said, "Do you want to write a book about this?" And it was the same thing, like, not really. You know, what more can I say? We're busy and it sucks, you know? And it took me a year, and really some people trying to convince me, it took me a year to think, okay, if I really wanted to do this, what would I really want to know? And I guess I didn't want the platitudes of like the 10 ways to do this, the 7 ways to do that. You know, if it were, because I bought all those magazines, and it would always be so, they would just leave me so frustrated that I didn't have any answers. And then I would read a lot of what they call the mommy train wreck books, and I would, you know, they'd be funny, and I would sort of feel, yeah, okay, I'm experiencing that, but I would be frustrated at the end. It's like, well, really, that's it? Or their answer would, like, you know, to move to the country. It's like, I can't do that, you know? It's like, what do you do? Like, or, you know, and I love Eat, Pray, Love, but it's like, well, I can't go meditate in a cave for, you know, till God appears in a cloud of blue smoke, you know? Like, what do you do right here, right now? So sometimes I was thinking, this is Eat, Pray, Love for the rest of us, you know? And so it took me a year to really think through what would I really want to know. And then I did write a proposal. And then when I started, I took a leave from the Washington Post, because there's no way on earth I could have. I really was starting from a deficit. I had never even read Betty Friedan. I mean, I didn't know any feminist stuff. And it took me about 18 months of a lot of writing, thinking, you know, making mistakes, calling the wrong people, calling the right people, and 18 months, and then I've turned the manuscript in.
I was wondering if there's anything in your book or anything you've researched where you saw the concept of the billable hour, like in a professional services firm, and have seen innovative ways to change that culture. I struggle with that myself. I am a co-owner of a CPA firm, so just getting past the April 15th. And I can't figure out how to change that idea. And we have people in the office, men who are single, who put massive amounts of time in to get the work done, and women who are just as smart, but actually can't because they have other obligations in their life. And so what have you found out about that?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. There's actually a section in the book, and it's actually more fully explored in the paperback version, about firms that have blown up the billable hour culture. And it's mainly law firms that I looked at, because there was one woman that I spoke to with this law firm called Valorum in Chicago, and she said, you know, it was crazy, because the more she had, she had one kid, she got more efficient, two kids, she got more and more efficient. And she said, you know, I was working so efficiently, and yet they would, you know, I could even win a case, or I could do something really great, and yet my firm valued the guy who put in the long hours, even if he didn't win, or if he didn't even do a particularly good job, but he worked the long hours so they got the money, and so he was the more valued employee. She said, you know, that was crazy. You know, it just sort of rewards inefficiency. And so they created an entirely new law firm. They call it the New Normal. And there's actually quite a few of them that have blown up the idea of billable hours. And they're experimenting. Lots of different firms do different things with alternative billing. There was this one firm that I profiled in the hardback called ClearSpire. And they since went out of business, not because of the model, but, I write about that, what happened in the paperback. But what they did is they took a construction, kind of like a construction approach. Somebody would come in with, this is the work, they task it out, everybody would estimate how much time it would take, they would bill that, and if somebody came back with they treated it like a change order, they wanted more work, you know, so construction change order. And then at the end of the project, if you used more time than you estimated, well, then you had to eat it as the employee. But if you saved time, then whatever you saved got split between the client, the owners, and you. So there was actually built-in efficiencies. So there are really creative things happening out there because the billable hours really, it's kind of a joke.
Hi, so I have my own business and I employ mainly women. We've got about 70 women and we have 2 men. And I've been trying really hard to get my management team to buy into a lot of these ideas. So we have meetings and we do a mindfulness minute at the beginning of them to just try to center. And a couple of people can't handle that. They can't sit and do it. And then we did new values for the company. And one of our values is being aware of our time and respectful of people's time. And I've tried asking them to no longer send emails after they're done work for the day. They won't listen. So I've gotten 6 emails from managers, and we talked about it today in a meeting, and I've gotten about 6 emails from managers tonight, and I've said, you need to stop doing that. I don't want you to do that. And if you choose, and they're women that are doing the flexible schedules, and I've said, okay, and they're well, we can't. I have to get this done now. Okay, if you choose to do it, you need to put it on a delayed send so that our hourly workers don't then feel like they have to be respond that they see those emails and that there's any implication that they need to be doing things. But the people that are on my leadership team are the ones that I'm having the hardest time to say to stop doing it. And I'm just wondering if you have any ideas of how long do I keep pushing them?
Well, you know, what you're talking about is, again, we've bought into this notion of the ideal worker. So you're fighting against a very powerful ideal, and really kind of the majority culture. Mm-hmm. You know, and the only thing you can do is keep at it. Mm-hmm. You change the narrative, change the ideals, change the role models, perhaps show a new narrative. Mm-hmm. Show them stories of other companies that have done this and actually succeeded. Show them the benefit of not being kind of constantly on call. Because mm-hmm. what you're talking about, Leslie Perlow writes, she calls it the cycle of responsiveness. Mm-hmm. And if you're sending an email at 3 in the morning because you want to show what a good worker you are, well, then everybody underneath you thinks, oh, my God, that's what I got to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and so then you just perpetuate this busyness that leaves you feeling slightly jet-lagged all the time because then you don't have a boundary and you're never away. Mm-hmm. Menlo Innovations, the company that I was talking about, they don't allow emails or cell phones. It's really frowned upon it, and they've made that very strong in their culture. And there was one woman I spoke with there, and she was putting in 70-hour work weeks, and she was, sending the emails. And the boss came to her and said, if you cannot figure out how to do your job in 40 hours, we will fire you. And she said, I had to go home and figure out how to have a life. So part of what you're dealing with is that this is a cultural value. It's going to be a tough change. Mm-hmm. But if you're the leader, you can really make it happen. And, you know, why do you know that you have 6 emails? Why are you checking your email?
Take my smartwatch. But I don't answer them anymore.
That's good.
So,
yeah,
I do,
model
I'm
it.
So part of that, though, I will say that for me, I don't answer them unless it's an emergency thing. And I have kids, and so I have a lot of times when I'm leaving and doing different things, and so I want to be able to have that flexibility. And for the women that do work part at home and part in the office, I want them to have that flexibility. And we value that a lot, that we have those times. It's for the people that have to clock in and clock out that I don't want to keep that mindset going for them. I don't want them to feel badly about it, because the ones that are mainly sending the emails at night are the ones that leave and go pick up their kids and do things, and then they do stuff after their kids. They have that ability to do that. And so I want to keep that value for them.
Right. The problem is the people who don't have that flexibility don't understand, and they think that they've been working straight through. Mm-hmm. So maybe some of that is just being very transparent, mm-hmm. why that's happening.
Mm-hmm. I think the delayed sending, too.
Delayed send.
Out of office on mine that says I'll respond in the morning.
You know, that's actually a really good thing when you set the expectations and build that into the response. You know, I will answer your email within the next 24 hours. I answer emails within these hours. When it's those times again, I will answer this email.
Thank you.
Got time for one last question.
One last question. I was curious, you profiled the company that where they did the 90 minutes on and then took a break. And I have it. I'm just curious what the research that you studied showed about kind of the time that you spend working versus playing versus working versus playing or working. So, for instance, I work and I have a very flexible schedule. I'm an attorney and I have three young kids, and it's important to me that because I have the same thing that you were talking about earlier about being the ideal mom and all of that stuff. So I want to, you know, be able to pick them up from school. But what I find is that you know, I'll go and I'll work for, you know, 4 hours or 5 hours, and then I'll go and do the mom thing for 2 hours, and then I'll go back to work for an hour, and then I'll do dinner for a couple hours, and then back to work. And I find that that's the hardest days for me, is when I have to transition so many times between work and home and work, or work and family, work and kids and back. And so if you did any of the research that you did showed kind of the efficiencies to having a chunk of time, because oftentimes I feel like if I just worked, you know, your traditional 40-hour work week that was this chunk of time is work, and then you go home and you just do home, it would be easier in a lot of ways.
You might want to try it, you know, try it as an experiment, because what you're describing is what they call role switching. And each of your roles has a lot of what they call task density. They're very, you know, your work is really intense. Your time as a mother is very intense, and so you're switching between these very intense, dense roles, and you're doing it several times, and that not only takes, you know, physical energy, but mental energy. And, you know, it's studies that have been done on, say, part-time workers, a lot of women who work part-time have the most time stress just because of that time switching, that role switching. So what you're describing actually sounds mentally exhausting.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting for you to describe the difference between quantity of time that you're spending with your kids versus quality. And I think that a lot of ways, just your traditional schedule of work time and home time would be easier in a lot of ways.
So maybe take an experiment. Try it for a day and see. Because one of the things that they're discovering really is bad for kids is when we're with them physically, but we're like in a minute, you know, in a minute, and or trying to do work. And, you know, I did that plenty, and that was... You know, it's sending your kids a message that I'm here, but I'm not really here, so you're not all that important. So we kill ourselves to be there, and then we're not really there. Mm-hmm. So we're not doing them any favors by doing that, nor are we doing ourselves, because you're not really fully able to work, and you're feeling kind of bad because you're, you know, you're not at work and you're not with your kids. You're kind of living in this nether world. So sometimes it is better. Do your work. Come home and be fully present. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. Bridget Schulte writes about work-life issues and the good life for The Washington Post. Schulte spoke at Town Hall Seattle on April 20th, 2015. This talk was presented by Town Hall Seattle and Third Place Books as part of the Civics series. Thanks to Edward Wolcher for our recording. Tune in next week for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.